Mark Cartier back with us here. Let's first of all talk about what's going on with you at Theatre at Monmouth, heading into the busiest time of your summer season in a big year at Theatre at Monmouth.
Yes, it's our 50th anniversary season at the Theatre at Monmouth, and it's my 23rd season there. Personally, we're doing, let's see, the shows that I'm in The Merry Wives of Windsor by a fellow by the name of William Shakespeare.
I've heard of him, yes.
He might go places.
Yes.
He wrote another one called Hamlet that's doing really well.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that,
yeah,
but
yeah.
It sounds good.
I'm playing some guy named Polonius in there.
But you're too young for that part.
Oh, not really. Not anymore. And also we're doing Ken Ludwig, who wrote, he's very famous for Lend Me a Tenor, but his adaptation of Baskerville. Holmes mystery. And we have only five actors in that. There's one guy plays Sherlock Holmes, one guy plays Dr. Watson, and then three of us play everybody else with so many costume changes that I don't need to do aerobics. It's unbelievable. We're just dripping in sweat, but it's a lot of fun. It's a crazy show.
That's awesome. Who are you in Merry Wives?
In Merry Wives, I'm Justice Shallow.
Oh, what a great part.
Yeah, it's fun.
I was the host.
Yep. The host of the Garter.
Bully Rook.
Yep.
Bully Stale. Bully. Well, we're here primarily, though, to talk Beatles because we're coming up on yet another anniversary. It seems like every year we hit another big one. And this time around, the 50th anniversary of Abbey Road, which was released in September of 1969.
Yep. Yep. It's really their final album, although Let It Be came out maybe 6 months later in 1970. Let It Be, most of the material for that was recorded first, earlier in 1969, and they let it sit in the vault for a long time. They weren't quite happy with those sessions. They were all live in the studio, except for the famous rooftop concert the last day. But then they started slowly recording some songs again with no real aim for an album. And then suddenly, halfway during the summer, McCartney got the idea for this big medley. He and Lennon had all these leftover songs that they didn't really want to finish, and they figured if they could put them all together, they could make a big medley, and that would be the basis for the album. So then he went to George Martin, their producer, and he said, "We want to make an album again." And Martin said, "Is everybody on board, even John?" And Paul assured him, "Yes, everybody wants to do this again." So they even got back their old engineer, Jeff Emmerich, who had quit early in the White Album sessions in frustration because the guys weren't getting along anymore.
Mm. And the White Album, we talked about it with you a couple of years ago. The White Album, I don't think this is completely accurate, but people have said that's a chronicle of a band breaking up, guys going their separate ways. But Abbey Road often feels to me like guys saying, this is probably it.
Yeah.
Whether they said it or not, but behaving and going back to the way they had done those albums in the mid-60s.
Right, yeah. They're playing together again as an ensemble. And they're playing tremendously. There was one day where Jeff Emmerich, the engineer I just mentioned, turned to George Martin in the control room, and he said, "They're playing fantastic again, like in the early days." And Martin said to him, "Yeah, you really can't tell that they hate each other. You'd never know, because they were having these business dealings at the time. They were breaking up. Paul McCartney wanted Linda Eastman, his eventual wife, her in-laws, to take over the business of the Beatles. John, George, and Ringo backed a guy by the name of Alan Klein. They eventually won, but McCartney went along grudgingly. What? So all of these things were going on. They were at each other's throats during the day, but once they got in the studio and it was about the music,
right. Everything
changed.
Well, let's talk about Alan Klein for a moment, because a lot of speculation that maybe the opening song in that medley, "You Never Give Me Your Money," is in large part about Alan Klein. Do you think that's the case, or is it just more general about all of the financial battles that they were already having?
I think Paul has finally admitted over the years in some interviews that it really was directed at the Klein situation. And even George, I think, agreed with him eventually, because he says the second line is, "You only give me your funny paper." And George says, "All we get is these pieces of paper saying how much we're worth. Nobody ever gives us any cash. We never see what we actually own." The business dealings of their original manager, Brian Epstein, were unfortunately horrible. He was a great promoter for the band, but he made a lousy bunch of business deals for them. So though they were the biggest act in the world, they were not the best paid.
What about the songwriting? Because by, at least by White Album, if not sooner, generally you saw a lot of guys writing their own songs off by themselves and then calling guys into the studio to add a part. Was there more songwriting collaboration on this album?
No, not really. Most of the snippets that John and Paul put together for the medley were written separately, and they didn't really give input to each other on these pieces anymore, but they strung them together. Really, Paul was doing the medley pretty much on his own until he said to John, "Do you have anything?" And John said, "Why, yes, I do." And he brought in a few pieces, and they strung all of these songs together, but they didn't really influence each other's writing that much anymore.
Well, one of the best of all the great Beatles songs kicks off the album, and maybe there's a message there in the opening tune.
Right, "Come Together" is actually was written, I think, as a somebody had asked him to, somebody was running for governor of California. Was it Jerry Brown? Was it Timothy Leary? It was somebody outrageous. And somebody asked John Lennon to write a campaign song called "Come Together."
Wow.
And that was the slogan for the campaign. And Lennon kind of had that and really couldn't come up with anything. And then he kept that idea and then strung these nonsense lyrics together for this amazing ensemble playing. The swampy bass lick that Paul plays. Great playing by the group on that song.
One of my favorite songs on the album, I think, is one of the best vocals McCartney ever did, although Lennon apparently always said he should have taken the lead on "Oh, Darlin'."
Yes, and you can actually hear them earlier in the year in the Get Back sessions play this song together. They tried it out at that point in time, and they sing it as a duet with John doing a harmony, and it plays quite well, and it's a different take. But McCartney went into the studio when they did the final version for Abbey Road every day to try to get the vocal first thing in the morning or first thing when he got to the studio, because he wanted his voice to be as raw as possible. And finally, after about a week of doing this, he settled on the one. That's the one. That's the one I want to put on the album.
We're talking with Mark Cartier here on Downtown. One of the key features of this album is the full emergence of George Harrison as a songwriter, at least for this album, an equal standing with McCartney and Lennon.
Yes, he really reaches his peak here, both as a Beatle and maybe for his entire career, with "Here Comes the Sun," which is a fantastic song. But "Something" is the one that everybody always remember. It becomes the second most covered Beatles song after "Yesterday."
Right. Was it Sinatra who said it's my favorite Lennon and McCartney song?
Yes, yes, yes. And even when Harrison met Michael Jackson years ago, he said Michael Jackson didn't realize it was a Lennon-McCartney song.
And he borrowed a little bit of that
from
James Taylor.
Yeah, "Something in the Way She Moves" is a James Taylor song. And James Taylor was an Apple artist at the time. He was being produced by Peter Asher of Peter and Gordon.
Another friend of Downtown.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah, he was awesome.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And he used that lyric to start off the song, but then he came up with this fantastic number, which is so beautiful in its simplicity, but they really built an incredible arrangement around it. McCartney's bass playing is fantastic. It's a great counterpoint to George's guitar line, but it's almost a little too busy, but they really mesh together very well. One thing that a lot of people don't know is that originally the song had a long extended coda, much like "Hey Jude" or from Abbey Road, "I Want You, She's So Heavy." It's a four-note theme played over and over and over again on the basic track. And it's really boring. I've heard it. It's really, really boring. It's the four Beatles, and Billy Preston was playing with them on this. And it just repeats. It's very repetitive. There's no vocal with it. It's just an instrumental riff. And finally, at the last minute, they convinced George, please lop that off because you've got a beautiful song. And he did. Maybe we'll hear it on the box set at the end of the year, a little bit of it, because it's not that good, honestly.
You mentioned "I Want You, She's So Heavy," an ode to Yoko, and musically, maybe one of the most intricate pieces the Beatles ever did.
Yeah, it's the song that they started first for this album, though they didn't know they were doing an album yet in February. It's the first one that they work on, and it's the last one that they finish in August, because John wanted layers and layers of sound. So he and George at points would go into the studio, into the corner with their guitars and add layers and layers of guitar, especially for the big buildup at the end. And then they also added the Moog synthesizer.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
George had one. It was a new thing at the time. And there's a white noise effect a very swirly white noise effect, and that's added into the big buildup at the end. It's also used a few other places on the album, but they used it very sparingly. I think a lot of artists would have tended to go overboard and made the album all about this great new sound. But George uses it a little bit on Here Comes the Sun. Mm-hmm. He plays it on John's beautiful three-part harmony song, Because. And Paul plays it on Maxwell's Silver Hammer. You can play the Moog synthesizer two ways, with a keyboard, or you can play it on a kind of like the, what is it called?
The theremin.
Yeah. With your finger going up and down a ribbon. And it's very difficult to play that way. But of course, McCartney is a musical genius, and he plays the solo in the middle of Maxwell's Silver Hammer on the Moog on a ribbon with his finger. It's crazy.
Like one of Paul's granny songs.
Yes.
Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
Yep, which also came out of the Get Back sessions earlier in the year. Many of the songs originally surfaced there, but didn't get their full treatment until the Abbey Road.
And that's the song that drove just about everybody in the band crazy.
Yes.
Because McCartney was such a perfectionist about getting just the right sound on.
Yeah, he made them play it over and over again, even in January of that year at Twickenham Film Studios. You can see it in the film Let It Be. Right. They play the song, and they've got somebody in there with an anvil doing the clang-clang sound with the anvil. And when they did it again in the summer for the album, John had been in an accident.
Car accident.
He and Yoko had been in a car accident, and he was back in the studio at this point in time, but he wasn't participating. He was just watching. He didn't play on the song. He didn't sing backing vocals on the song. He just sat there. He wanted nothing to do with it.
You mentioned Because, the beautiful harmonies in that, and not just three Beatles, but essentially nine Beatles.
Right, because George Martin, the producer, laid out the harmonies for them and made them record the song three times. So you've got nine voices there, and it's just so lush and so beautiful. On the anthology, they presented it without the instrumentation at all. You just hear the voices, and it's heavenly.
The centerpiece of the album, though, as you said, is that medley, and it's incredible because it's got, that's the best of the band in so many ways, with the McCartney songs, and closes out with maybe the best guitar work you'll hear. And what a great farewell, the three different guitar solos that wrap it up.
Right. They knew that they wanted a guitar solo, but they decided that they would each take a turn. When they were talking about it before they went down onto the floor, Paul said, I've got a great kickoff. I've got a piece I want to play to start it. John said, I've got a great finish. By default, as usual, George winds up in the middle. So they play three times each. And it's just amazing. You can hear their different styles as they play. And just recently, we heard Paul McCartney play it live in L.A. with Joe Walsh of the Eagles. And they do a fantastic extended version of it themselves.
Of course, Joe now with a little family connection to the Beatles.
That's right. He's connected through Ringo. They're in-laws in some way, right?
I love all the little snippets. It's hard to pick a favorite in that medley because they're all such interesting, incomplete tunes in their own right. Is there a favorite part of it for you?
I not really. No, because they are, like you say, they're all different. They all have their own personality. Two of the songs that John brought in were actually, we heard them last year on the White Album because he had Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam before the White Album even. But he saves it until now to use these snippets. Paul had She Came In Through the Bathroom Window in the Get Back sessions in January, and they play a very slow, bluesy version of the song at those sessions, but he sped it up to make it fit in the medley with John's songs. It's amazing how it all fits together, really.
And if you think about it, not that it was planned, but is there a better lyrical finish to the Beatles' career than what we get at the conclusion of the end.
Right. And in the end, the love you make is equal to the love you take?
Yeah.
Take? Make? Did I flip that? I may have. But we also have Her Majesty. I told you that story, didn't I?
I'm not sure.
Her Majesty is a little snippet that
which as a kid was my favorite part of it.
Oh, yeah. It's a little snippet that Paul did one day going in, and he said, oh, this would work great in the medley. When they initially put the medley together, Her Majesty was between two of John's songs, Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam. They listened to a rough cut of the medley and they said, it really doesn't work. Cut it out. an engineer who did this was told to never throw anything away. So at the end of the medley, he had about 20-something seconds of leader tape, and then he added the medley. The next time they listened to it, they listened to the medley. They said, oh, this is great. They started talking about it, and then suddenly they heard Her Majesty play. And they went, that's great. Leave it. So it became the end of the album.
Yeah.
It's not even listed on early copies of the album. So if you have one of the early copies, it's worth money.
That's why you don't pick up that needle too early.
That's right. That's right.
People are like, needles. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? So how do you rank this album in the pantheon of Beatle greats?
Okay. I'm going to admit now, overall, a lot of people consider it one of their masterpieces. And I do think it ranks among them. And many think it's their very best. I don't. I'm more along the lines of Revolver, Rubber Soul, Sgt. Pepper myself.
Yeah.
Even A Hard Day's Night. I love A Hard Day's Night. It's a great, great early album where everything came together and they wrote every song on that album for the first time. This one's up there, but not quite. Also because it's a little too clean, a little too pristine.
Yeah.
It's the first album that's all 8-track. Even the engineer, Jeff Emmerich, said he didn't like it that much because it was so clean, so precise. But in a way, the Beatles were laying out the template for 1970s rock right here.
Oh, yes.
Studio corporate rock. That's the sound right there.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I would probably make it fourth on my list. I go back and forth often between Revolver and Rubber Soul. It's my all-time favorite.
Yeah.
But it's great. And I do just love the idea that it was them being a band one last time.
Yeah. And they maybe knew it, they maybe didn't know it, but right around the time the album was released, that's when John Lennon went to the band and said, I'm out. But they kept it quiet for months, which is amazing that they could even do that. But it was really over.
Have you seen Yesterday yet?
I have not. What a great idea. What
it is
what a brilliant concept.
It's got mixed reviews from people, and I get it because it's Richard Curtis who does these rom-coms. It sort of veers away from the concept. They get a little bit enmeshed in the love story, but the musical part of it, it's just great.
Yeah.
And it's just a reminder to those of us who love the Beatles from Jump Street, but I think it's great that it's exposing a new audience. Not that you need to do that, and yet, I think I saw the other day, 4 or 5 Beatles songs have re-entered the rock charts for the first time in years.
It's amazing how that happens. Every time somebody, going as far back as Ferris Bueller's Day Off,
right,
when they used Twist and Shout, Twist and Shout charted again after that movie. It's incredible. Their influence comes back time and time again.
What do you think will happen with those vaults? I mean, there's so much music in there that we still haven't heard, and there'll be more reissues, I'm sure. But are there songs in there that we've never heard at all, do you think, that we might finally get a glimpse of down the road?
I don't know if that's even possible anymore, but when they did the anthology series, they did find a demo that George had done called You Know What to Do around the time of A Hard Day's Night. He had no memory of it. No memory of it. He did this demo, and it's a pretty good song. Maybe they could have fleshed it out and fit it on an album, but they forgot about it, and it left on the proverbial cutting room floor, I guess.
For people who would like to hear more from Mark, you do a wonderful thing every year at Theater at Monmouth. Talk a little bit about that and when people can see you.
I've been celebrating these 50th anniversaries. I did it with the film A Hard Day's Night in
14?
What was that, 14?
Yeah.
Yep, okay. Thank you for doing the math for me. I did Sgt. Pepper. I did the White Album, and this year it's going to be Abbey Road. So the program is called And in the End, The Making of Abbey Road. And I'm going to do this on Monday, July 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Theater at Monmouth in Monmouth, Maine. And it's about an hour and 15 minutes long. You'll hear much of what we just talked about and much, much more. And I play musical selections to illustrate as I'm going along. Some of the finished versions and some of the rough cut versions.
I can't wait for that. 29th, Theater at Monmouth. The Shakespearean Theater of Maine celebrating their 50th anniversary, and you're 23rd there. That's crazy.
It's fantastic. I never thought I'd last that long. Neither did they, probably.
Mark, always good to see you. Thanks for coming up.
Great. Thanks for having me.